Sporting great, Ora Washington.
Who was Ora Washington?
A born competitor, Ora was champion in two sports.
She was the Michael Jordan of women's basketball.
She was a tennis champion.
But while she was fighting for titles on the courts, she was facing prejudice off them.
The reason is racism and sexism.
Untold Legends, Ora, a podcast from the BBC World Service and BBC Sounds, tells her remarkable story. Search for Untold Legends wherever you found this podcast.
Alongside BBC's athletics commentator Ed Harry and Paralympian Scout Bassett, I'm Eliza Skinner, and this is On the Podium on the BBC World Service, a place for Olympians and Paralympians to share their amazing journey to the top. We're a home for brawn and a surprising amount of brains, where muscles are not just plucked from the sea, steamed and eaten with a delicious creamy sauce with a dash of white wine and pepper and onions. I have completely lost my train of thought. Let's get to the show. Last week, we debated the best stadium snacks for watching sport. This time, we have the ultimate discussion for arena eating. Hot dogs. Are they sandwich or are they not?
But I like your question.
Do you have an opinion on this?
Yes, I have a very strong opinion on this. A hot dog is not a sandwich. It's its own category. It's a hot dog because there's one piece of bread that's connected with a hot dog or a sausage in the middle of that bread, but they're not separated.
Do you feel that way about any kind of bun situation? Like if you had a hamburger, but it was still a little bit connected on one side of the bun, would you be like, this is not a sandwich either. This is a hamburger.
That's good. But I feel like hamburger buns, they're not connected. They're separated. When you go to a restaurant, hamburgers, hot dogs, they're not listed under sandwiches.
That's true.
Right. Or if you were going to be, you were somewhere and somebody said, oh, we're going to be ordering sandwiches for y'all. Great. Awesome. What are my options? Well, actually, it's a hot dog. I'd be like, no, that's not what you told me.
You know, I used to have I used to trade sandwiches with this other kid in school, and her mom was German, and she would make sandwiches on pumpernickel bread with radishes and sliced hot dog.
Ooh.
Those were great. And that was a hot dog sandwich.
That was a hot dog sandwich.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that's understanding that is in the world. That's what a hot dog sandwich is.
They're the people pushing the boundaries. A hot dog sandwich.
While we're on this path of silliness.
Is it silly?
Does a straw have one hole or two holes?
Two. It's not a straw if it has one hole.
Otherwise you can't get your drink through it.
It's not two holes, one continuous hole.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Wow. Yeah. I've never thought about this before, but you might have something here.
All right. What's the line between smoothie and soup?
Ooh.
You can have cold soup.
You can. But aren't soups savory?
Is it purely savory? You could have a melon soup. I think it's a spoon. I think it's just the spoon. I think you put a spoon in a smoothie, that's a soup now.
No, but you're right. It's how you legitimize stuff. If you put a spoon in it, someone goes, well, fair dues, there's a spoon in that now. So yeah.
If you drop a soap on a floor, is the soap now dirty or is the floor now clean?
Well, the floor is not clean. The soap is dirty.
But if the soap is on the floor, is the floor now clean?
I don't trust you to ever clean anything that I have to come in contact with now, Scout, if that is actually an issue that you are unsure about. I dropped soap on it. Those dishes are all clean. Okay, time to meet our guest. Ed, who's on the podium?
Our guest today is a seven-time Olympian, a sailor who went to his first games in Seoul, South Korea in 1988. He won bronze medals for Argentina in 2004 and 2008 before striking gold in Rio in 2016 at the age of 54. That success came less than a year after having most of his left lung removed because of cancer. Santiago Lange, welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you very much.
We're very happy to have you here. We have some pictures we're going to look at throughout your career and your life, sort of guide our journey. So let's take a look at the first one.
Wow. You started with an easy one.
Well, this is the podium from the Rio Olympic Games in 2016. Now, we mentioned the very serious health issues you had in the year leading up to Rio. But first of all, Tell us about this moment. Tell us about winning gold. And the first thing that strikes us looking at this picture is we've got the mountains in the background there in Rio, but there are six of you on the podium, three pairs. So who was your sailing partner when you won this gold medal? And just take us back to that moment that you both stood there on the podium as gold medalists.
Yeah, for sure. I start introducing my partner because obviously this is a team sport and without her would have been impossible. Cecilia Carranza is from Argentina, an outstanding sailor and a great partner for those hard years that we live together. I think I couldn't have a better teammate to go through all what we had to live, the cancer and my surgery just 1 year before the game. So the whole team, not only her, were there in the podium with us. And yes, when you stand in the podium so much, you have achieved a dream. In my case, such a long dream. My first try to go to the Olympic Games was in 1980, and this is 2016. So it was a very long journey to get to here. You certainly remember milestones that you have made in that journey, and friends and coaches and mates. Obviously, Carlos Spinola, which I won two medals, and we always missed the gold for a little bit. And for sure, he was there in that podium with me.
What did it feel like finally hearing that your national anthem on the podium?
For sure, I cried. We as Argentinians, I am not nationalist. I am a big fan of the whole world united. But when it comes to sport and when you are competing or when it's following a tradition to be part of a piece of land or that you live and you are born, I am very proud of, and to represent your country. And even now I get emotional to represent your country and hear your anthem and see your flag on top of everyone. It's too emotional, too emotional, really.
In this second photo of you with Cecilia on the podium, your head is leaning back almost as if you a sense of relief, or perhaps you're just soaking in the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the emotions in this photo?
Yeah, you are spot on. For sure, relieved, and then calmness and happiness. I think it's the expression of total happiness. I'm pretty sure in this moment I was remembering my father. It's so emotional moments. It's unbelievable the amount of things you can think of in such a short period of time.
You've been to seven Olympic Games, hopefully an eighth next year. But of the seven that you've been to, is there one that was your favorite or perhaps the most significant for you?
It's a very interesting question. You know, if I take it into results, for sure, Rio was unbelievable in that podium. My mother, that is now 93, was there watching. You know, my brothers managed to brought her. You know, the fact that was so close to Buenos Aires. All my sons were there. Two of them racing. A lot of friends came to visit for the medal race. For sure, was incredible emotion. But I cannot read off when we won the first medal after 25 years of dreaming of it. My first Olympics, and the other two in Atlanta and Sydney that we didn't win a medal, but was an incredible lesson learned. It was part of the journey. So I think every Olympic had a very important memory in myself and very special.
You mentioned your father. He was a sailor too, wasn't he? And he went to the Olympic Games, I think, in 1952. Is that where your passion for the Olympics came from? What made you want to go that first time, and why does that passion still burn so brightly?
It's a difficult question in some way. I'm sure all the story of my father had something to do, because I remember the Argentinian with the Olympic rings. Back then, they were sewn into the jacket. Was for some reason in the library of my room at my house. And I remember very clearly having that in my mind. But I was not that kind of story that when I was young, I was dreaming to go to an Olympic game because in sailing coming from Argentina, that was impossible. But then, step by step, we were trying. I was lucky enough to be in a generation of sailors in Argentina that we were crazy enough to dream. and to push the limits. And I had a lot of outstanding, great sailors on my side that were beating me all the time. And I think that push between all of us gave us the ability to dream. And then it came Seoul. That there was an amazing story because I went with a borrowed boat from the British team. I borrowed the sails from the American team, and we didn't do any international regattas. We just arrived there 2 days before we compete. It was all kind of crazy. I didn't even know where I was. And suddenly we finished ninth, we won a race, and that was the turning point that I said, if we find the money, the knowledge, and we fight for it, we may have a chance at it. And that's how everything started, really.
It strikes me there you have been going to the Olympics for so long and been standing on that podium for so long. When you were finally there in 2016, do you feel like you were the same person that started going to those games?
I hope we are different.
Yeah.
That means that we are learning along the way. For sure, as an athlete, certain things that you have inside, some values, that will never change. You know, the values of honesty, team member, responsibility, determination, hard work, all those values. And then as a human being, obviously, we learn a lot. I think we have to be an athlete is really cool because we are able to travel the world and learn about different cultures and a lot of things. I hope I improved since 1988.
Given that sailing is a bit of a niche, unique sport, I'm sure you spend lots of time on your technique and work in the boat, but outside of the boat, is there a lot of physical training that's involved in preparing to sail?
So for sure, I believe that on sailing is an incredible sport, mainly because we play with nature. And so we have a factor that absolutely is outside ourselves and we don't control. So we need to really work on ourselves to accept. It's a sport that you not only play against your opposition and against yourself to improve an athlete, but we play against the nature. And along the years, you know, when I was young, maybe at the beginning was all about winning. Then I went through different process. And today that we are trying to get to Paris, for me, it's all about enjoying every day and training, maybe. I sometimes question myself. I enjoy more pushing myself and my team hard than actually the competition, because I am such a big believer that in modern sport today, everything happens before you actually compete. In sailing, going to your question, is a lot about technique, a lot. You have to be sensitive enough to sail the boat fast and sensitive enough to read the wind and understand what the wind is going to do during that race, which side of the course is favored. You have to read the sea and know, okay, here will be less current or less wind. And then there is a lot of work to be done in the boat. And then obviously, depending on the different categories of sailing, in some of them you need to be extremely fit. The one I do, yes, you have to be obviously a professional athlete, but we don't depend so much in our physical strengths. Here, because we also play with a boat, you know, our physical conditions is not so the final say.
Just so that I'm clear, the sailing teams, since I am not a sailor myself, there's two of you on the boat, but how are you also doing everything as far as upkeep? Like how many other people are part of this full sailing team? Well,
don't worry, you will never have it clear with sailing. That's why it's such an unpopular sport.
Okay.
So now we are talking about Olympic sailing, because then you have probably some of you have heard of the America's Cup, that the team is 200 people, or the round the world race, that the team is 50 or 60 people. So that's the other cool thing about the sport. And I've been lucky enough to have done the three. I've been involved in the America's Cup. I have done the round the world race, and I have been doing the Olympics. So in the Olympics, there are some categories that is only one and some others that are two. In our case, the ones I went to Tokyo and Rio is a mandatory mixed in our sport, which is a very interesting factor. You know, when the Olympic committee pushed 20 years ago that all this should be the same amount of athletes, women than men, which we achieve in Tokyo and we are continue to achieving. Our sport, instead of having a woman in sailing in one side and men in the other one, went for the mixed disciplines. And so it is interesting because it's another approach to the reality that we want equality, you know. And so we are two. We normally have a meteorologist. She's very, very important to me. Then we have obviously a physical trainer, which has physios. We have some mechanics people that work in our boat. Sometimes we have designers that help us to develop some aspects of the boat. And yeah, we have coaches that goes in the water, and sometimes before a race will help us to read the wind and understand which way we should play the game. But we have to learn being our own coach as well. Mm-hmm. And so we have a good feeling what's going on in the boat, and then we come back and we see videos, we analyze the data, and then we can come to do the conclusions together. But while you are racing, it's all about you, no?
You said you've got a meteorologist that you work with. That is presumably somebody who can tell you what the wind is going to do, because without the wind, your boat's not going anywhere.
Yes. Obviously, it's fascinating to make a boat go faster through the water in all terms, in sensibility, in terms of technology. But the more artist part of our sport, the more intuitive part of our sport, the most difficult to understand is reading the wind. And, you know, I come from an age where the meteorologists didn't know much, and I'm lucky enough to have seen how good they had become. Today, it's incredible what a good meteorologist, the information that can tell you, you know, they can tell you, okay, in half an hour, the wind will do this, which is amazing. Or we go to a new place. Or like if I go and sail in Buenos Aires, that is a place that I've been sailing all my life, and I know all the little tricks the wind can do there. She from Italy can tell me what's going on, you know. And so it's pretty fascinating how the technology in terms of weather. But still, you know, then when you are racing, it's so cool because it's a big debate of if you are not in line. We do a lot of yoga in our preparation to be in line to ourselves, not to fool ourselves. Like you sometimes, because of pressure, you see wind where there is no wind. You know, you're trying to solve a problem and you take risks that you shouldn't be taking because you are fooling yourself. And so all this to be really aligned with yourself and understanding what's going on and being able to read the wind in a very careful way is a really mind game, which is really, really interesting, and I am passionate about it.
Yeah, you wrote a book that has something to do with it, I've heard. Called Wind.
Yeah, that's why it was not called Sea. It could have been called Sea as well, you know.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. With us is Argentine sailor and gold medalist Santiago Lange. And Ed, I think we have another picture.
This is the next picture, and it's you in a hospital bed. We made reference to this right at the beginning of our conversation. The year before the Rio Olympics, the year before you won gold, you had surgery because you had lung cancer and you lost 80% of your left lung. I suppose if we rewind back a little bit further, when did you first realize that you were ill? And I suppose, when did you realize potentially how serious it was?
Well, that picture is the day of my birthday. Actually, I got surgery the day of my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Something that happened. Happy birthday.
It's a weird way to celebrate, but, you know, whatever you need.
Yeah, at the end, it's a celebration. No? You get rid of the thing. Why not? No, I realized, you know, we in years 2013 and 14, we travel a lot, and I was not feeling good. Every time I took a plane, I was getting ill all the time with a kind of a cold. I was, you know, one ibuprofen, then paracetamol, and every time more and more, then antibiotics to compete. And suddenly in March of 2013, 2015, I said to Ceci that we were preparing for the Olympics. I said, we cannot continue like this. I have to take care of my health, because we went to the first regatta of the European season in Palma, Mallorca, and I was totally dead. I went back home and I did a scan, and they found it. And then was a big deal for me, you know, because I thought that that was my career over, and I was trying to find ways to not get surgery. And I was crazy enough to hold that till September. And I was pushing the doctors not to do that, because I had the European Championships in September in Barcelona, coincidentally, where I decided to get surgery. And then the three doctors shut me down in a room and I said, if you don't get surgery soon, you are taking too much risk. Obviously, then when they put me so tight or so serious, I said, yes, you have to trust doctors because they know a lot. So I said, yes, as soon as I can, so I have time to arrive to Rio. And the guy opened the agenda and said, the 22nd of September, which is my birthday. So there I was.
In most cases, when cancer has spread to the lung, that's usually a worst case, you know, scenario for most people. And I'm, you know, you hinted at you thought your career might have been over. Not to be morbid, but did death ever cross your mind?
Of course, yes. I feel like now, I feel like I have such an incredible life that I didn't really. I arrive and I have talks with very close friends saying, well, no problem.
So you were at peace in some ways.
Yeah, really in peace. Yes. I am still there. Back then, I'm not saying that it's wise or crazy, but back then when I had and I have deep conversation with friends, I said, what's the difference between 10 years later or younger? and I am lucky enough to look behind and know that I have a great family, I have great friends, and I have lived a very fun life. You know, I have done always what I wanted to do, so I didn't have any fear about it, about death. Absolutely not.
What was the recovery like from that? I imagine that recovery would be daunting under any circumstances, but with the goal of the Olympics at the end of it, how did you get through that?
That's what we are lucky being athletes and high performance athletes. And as I said before, coming from a sport of sailing, that you need to accept the nature. And, you know, the next day I asked for a physio and to start training. So the next day, as soon as I wake up, I was blowing little balloons and start exercising. And, you know, I was lucky enough, and that's one of the reasons why I chose these doctors, because they were big believers in doing things to recover. Immediately I was walking in the hospital with my sons. After that was just pushing, and all the time, every single minute. You know, like day five, when they left me out of the hospital, I went to see the race of the European Championship to try to learn from the rivals what they were doing and how they were sailing. And then I started walking 5 kilometers a day. And day 10, I was riding my bike. And I remember in day 15 or something, I was riding my bike up the hills at maximum heart rate. And I stopped it because I was thinking, what happened if it get unsue or something? And
did your doctors know you were doing that?
Some things yes, some things no. And so I stopped my bike and I called the doctor and said, it's okay. He said, no, you're fine.
Okay.
Keep pushing. I didn't tell him that I was at maximum heart rate, but that's another story. I can only travel after day 30, and then we travel to Argentina and immediately we start sailing. I didn't have the energy. It was really exhausting to start sailing. From then on, was all the time like that. And I was crazy, because then I got fights with my coaches and with Ceci, because I thought they were not pushing enough. And we had a meeting in November in Argentina, and I pushed the team to go and live in Rio so we could train every day where the Olympics were going to be. And we have bright ideas and an incredible team. You know, it's from these things you don't come out alone, for sure. My sons, my family, my team, and my friends are an enormous part of this history. You know, I think it's written everywhere, whoever runs this, to be able to have a close family and a tight family or friends is the difference. No? And I think I was just very hungry to turn the things around, extremely hungry. And when you ask the question about the podium, I felt back then that, you know, I never understood why we didn't win the gold with Carlos and why we won it with Ceci. And then not more than 1 year ago or two, I realized that the team we did with Ceci, we went through such a hard moment that we didn't have any distractions or any no complaints, because everything that we leave was so big. Then when we were under pressure, I think the team have something special.
Your teammate, Cecilia, what was her reaction to your diagnosis? And was there any doubt that you two were going to stay together for Tokyo? Or did you ever make any plans to have her train with somebody else or possibly a different teammate?
No, we were together and she was always supportive and nothing of that happened. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to sail again. I tried to search for library of high performance athletes going through this kind of and I couldn't find. So I was reluctant to believe the doctors that tell me, you will be okay. You know, yes, I believe them, but to a certain extent. So I didn't really know if I was going to be able to sail an Olympic boat again. During the period that I was in doubt to get surgery, she was really worried, like my family as well. They were all worried that I was taking too much risk on not getting surgery urgently. And if I have to leave it again, I will do the same, I think. When I'm talking about my body, I want to understand very well what's going on. And actually, I had really deep conversations with my doctors that they were not used to have people asking so many questions and, you know, not saying yes to everything. And in a certain way, I'm telling you this because I find it interesting. You know, sometimes they feel too much of a responsibility because people are putting their lives to them and them making the decision for the patients. And I was the opposite. Obviously, I trust a doctor 100%, but I was asking and understanding, but I always felt that the decision should come from me.
Obviously, it's all about the actual sailing. What you did in Rio, you talked about instinct and feel and being prepared and everything else. But do you think there was also something that we almost don't really necessarily have a name for, almost a destiny?
Yes.
That after what you went through, this was going to be your Olympics?
This destiny world, you know, with Carlos, we arrived to Athens. We were European champions, world champions, and number one in the ranking, and we didn't make it. When I do the analysis of that Olympics, I never could find technically why we lost it. And suddenly in Rio, we make it. And then you say, why? This is destiny? It's not destiny. And then I try to answer that question. And when I analyze sport, I don't believe in luck. We have to analyze sport as a fact. Luck, destiny, whatever, doesn't exist. If someone beat you, it's because he has been better than you, and you have to adjust something in your training, in your way of preparation, in the way you race, in whatever. But sometimes when I do it personally, we are relaxing, talking, you know, destiny is a beautiful word. And sometimes it comes your way, sometimes it doesn't. And yes, and then as a normal person, I believe in destiny.
So the athlete part, not as much, but the normal person part, yes.
The athlete absolutely doesn't even a millimeter give to destiny.
It does also sound like you perform especially well when the odds are sort of against you. And I'm assuming that, as you said, there wasn't a whole lot of records for people winning gold Olympic medals with this kind of surgery before you. Do you think that the underdog or the odds against you is part of it for you?
Absolutely, yes. It's the reality of our story. You know, we come from Argentina, and the answer comes when I tell you we could not even dream to win a medal. So I remember when we started sailing for the Olympics in Athens, suddenly a big economic crisis came to Argentina, and, you know, it was just impossible. So we were driving boats of our rivals along Europe to be able to get our boat there. And I can tell you hundreds of stories like that. And we strongly believe that all those things can make us better athletes. Within our meteorology, we think that every stone that we have to turn, because we come from a different country, will make us stronger. And I possibly think you are 100% right. It's how I feel with the athlete, that as soon as things get worse, we have more chances.
You're a bit more weathered. Wind again. I think we have another photo of you. Let's see what the next photo is.
It's cool, this interview with Potas. I like it. Oh. Well, that's the only important thing in life, the family, for sure. My four kids.
This is you on a beach, I think, with...
Yes.
With your children, four children?
Yes.
I'm glad you're on a beach. It means you're near the sea, and that's good. What's it been like for your family to be on this journey with you? And what are your memories as you look at this picture? They must all be kind of somewhere between the ages of 12 and downwards, and they look very happy, and they're all piled right on top of Dad there.
And that's an old picture. Now I am a granddad. Very happy how they are today. One is a jazz musician, Borja and Theo are artists, and Iago and Klaus actually has been in the Olympics in Rio. No, they were competing themselves. So, you know, we talk about the podium, but for me, as emotional as the podium was to enter the Olympic stadium together with my sons as a teammates, you know, not as a coach or being in the stadium as a father. And for me, within the Olympic values, the open ceremony of the Olympic Games is truly world in peace. It means a lot to me, and I was able to talk about this with my sons coming into the stadium. I said, this is the only time you will see the whole world, all the religions, all the colors, all having fun and well-dressed and having a party together. And that's the open ceremony of the Olympic Games for me. It means so much to the world to me. It's so, so important. I think there are not many people in this world that being able to enter a stadium like that with your sons, you know.
You mentioned that two of your sons are Olympic sailors. How do you balance between, obviously you have a very storied career in the sport also. How do you balance being a father with also perhaps being a coach, or do you only offer advice when they ask for it, or you see something and you point it out to them? How do you balance those two things?
It's difficult, very difficult. Actually, they called me to be the coach. I was running in a beach in a summer and said, no, I cannot be the coach. I will never be able to push them as hard as they need to. If I have to coach them, I will suffer too much in the motorboat watching a race. And so I could not be cold enough to give good advice when it takes. And so I had to explain that to my son. I said, well, I have to step out of your offer. I won't be your coach. I'm happy to advise and be part of your team as an advisor, but it's too much to be a coach of your son, I think.
I imagine that even though only two of them became sailors, I'm imagining that your family probably grew up on the water quite a bit. and it sounds like you are... Like, what would you say the percentage of your life is on land and is on water? Like, it sounds like a lot more than normal people.
I think more in the water than in the land.
Really?
Well, at least I don't know physically, but my mind for sure. And when I got divorced, I lived 4 years with my sons in a boat. So, and Iago keep telling, you know, his love, his passion for the sea comes from that period. You know, many times in the times of divorce are really sad times or difficult times. In our case, all my child remembers those 4 years that we live in a boat as one, very special ones. Yeah, because I didn't have money. I left the house to my ex-wife and I borrowed a boat for a while. And then I bought my own boat, an old boat without an engine to be able to live with them. And yes, we went to school from the boat, and we had shower in the showers of the club because we didn't have showers, and we had virtually nothing in the boat, and fishing at night is an incredible life. And the good thing of the boat is that make you tight, you know. We were all together. It's not much room. We had to see each other every day, every minute. And yeah, it was an incredible experience. And I think that all of them, even if the one, two are sailors, all of them have a big passion for the sea and the nature.
I have a silly question, but it's actually about logistics. So like for me, I run track and field, and most athletes, you just bring your equipment on the plane. How do you get the boat from one country or one location to a next? I'm just wondering how that works from a logistics. Do you take it apart, or how does that work?
Can I hate you?
Oh, this is a difficult answer, isn't it? I just was like, how do they get it from one place to the next?
I am so jealous. I am so jealous of any other athlete.
Yeah, I used to be a drummer, and everyone else in my band would just like show up with their little guitar, and I'd be hauling drum after drum, and I'm like, I hate all of you.
This is like that and worse. In the Olympic circuit, you will have four boats, one in Argentina, one in Europe, one traveling the world, and an extra one that is the one you like that you only use for important events. But then you have 10 masts and X amount of sails and centerboards and rudders that are all different, and you know the boats have life and one boat is better than the other one, and then to test if you are sailing good you don't know, because that time you were competing with another boat and you have to carry all around the world. It's just crazy, you know. And when we were poor, like I was studying in England in Southampton, and I, for me, being in Europe, being able to go to some international regatta was like paradise. And so I finished university and I went in by train with the mass of the boat that measures 7 meters, the centerboard and rudders and the sail and my personal gear.
On the train?
On the train from Southampton to London, Victoria. And then I took the train to Paris, and then I went all the way to Italy. And I did all sort of crazy things. And when I was living in Southampton, was a French nationals in Brest, and I took the ferry just with the boat and the little dolly without car into the ferry. And the guys were saying, where's your car? No car, it's just a boat. But now we are more professionals. We have some money, we have good sponsors, and we can deal with it in a better way.
I had no idea how much boat borrowing there was in all of this.
A lot.
It seems there's a real sense of community in international sailing, not just in terms of competition, because you said, you know, you share ideas and approaches with each other. People lend each other boats, and then when it isn't professional sailing and you needed somewhere to live, someone lent you a boat to live on. I mean, when you look at other sports, things I cover athletics, and two 100 meter sprinters would never help each other. There's this almost like two boxers. Do you think it's entirely appropriate that you gravitated towards a sport which has this community feel to it?
You know, it's an interesting question, because in my mind, I will question that most of the Olympic sports are the same, but I may be wrong. When you see an Olympic podium, you see so much friendship. There's three values on the Olympics, is respect, friendship, and excellence. There is a reason why those values are there, and I'm sure it's a big part of the Olympic spirit. Then obviously we compete fiercely, but there is a good, really good atmosphere. You know, like anything in other professions, there are some people that you don't get on well, but the atmosphere is really, really good. I think that's another important feature of our sport, that we don't have people watching us. And so the people that do it is because they really love what they do. Is no egos involved of showing off, or I don't know. Here we are alone doing in the middle of the sea, competing fiercely and losing and winning and having sad or incredible emotions, but you are alone. You are in the middle of the sea, and we train every day alone in the middle of the sea. No one watches training or anything like that. When we debate about getting our sport popular, sometimes I think we should keep it the same, because in the future everything will come as a spectacle, and we will be the only one that are authentic or different.
Well, we will be pulling for you. Although, given your track record, I feel like you'll be doing this in a Harry Houdini wrapped in ropes and still win.
We will try.
Yes, we will be pulling for you and rooting for you in all of your trials, and then hopefully the Olympics also. Thank you so much for giving us this time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. It's a very unique interview. And I really enjoyed it. So thank you so, so much.
Well, I feel like I need to become a sailing enthusiast now. I might have just become a sailing enthusiast. He was great.
Yeah. I went to my first Olympics to report in 2004. Went to my first Paralympics in 2008. And obviously, even before that, I would be interviewing Olympians and Paralympians different times. I've never met anyone who embodies and uses the values of, I think the word is Olympism, and applies them to their day-to-day life and does so authentically, because there is an oath, an athlete's oath, which comes at the opening ceremony, and it's meant to be on behalf of all the athletes. And there's obviously charters, and there's what each of the individual rings means and all the rest of it. But he actually embodies that. And it's the building blocks of everything he does. And that's, to me, fantastic. I'm not saying other athletes in other sports aren't like that. I've just never met someone who expressed it so beautifully.
You know, I got to thinking about when he talked about having lung cancer, and to me, he seemed like the perfect informed patient, because he's right. So often you get a diagnosis, or you go in and whatever the doctor tells you or whatever they suggest, you just go with. And I get in trouble all the time for this, because I ask a lot of why questions to my coach and basically everybody I work with. Why are we doing something? What is the thought process? And it's not to be like disrespectful or anything, but like him, I'm very inquisitive. I want to know why we're doing something, not just, well, I'm the expert and you should just listen. Of course, I'm going to listen and I'm going to follow the lead, but it's also nice to know the process or you know, make informed decisions. I thought he had an interesting point about that.
That is the way to do it, right? To ask the person that you're working with, the expert, because I think the bad rap that being overly informed about medicine gets is from people looking things up on the internet, from people not actually having conversations with the experts.
I can be my own doctor.
Yeah, they'll be like, got it. I'm worried about all of this. But instead of asking you, I'm just going to go home and look it up on the internet, where mm-hmm. anyone can write anything. Mm-hmm. Oh, and speaking of writing, I really want to read his book. Just this idea of wind as it has traveled through his life, like not only as a major force in sailing, but also he lost so much of his connection with it by losing, his breath, and having to rebuild that and forge sort of a new relationship with it. It's one of those things that we forget how fundamental it is until it blows over something in your yard or becomes a nuisance.
Yeah, I love the community thing as well. I love the idea that he went to Southampton University on the England south coast. And I love this idea that, I don't know, if you were walking around Southampton in the late 70s or the early 1980s, you maybe saw a student from Argentina carrying a 7-meter long mast as he got on the train and took that mast to London with
him. Yeah.
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
We've come so far, and that the first person people think of when they think of strength could be a Paralympian, could be a para-athlete. And 16-year-old me will be surprised that we've come this far. Just really, really proud of everything that we've managed to achieve as a country.
Singapore's most decorated athlete, Yip Pin Xiu, on challenging stereotypes of disability with sport. Next time on The Podium.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
People go to jail here for insulting the president. People are afraid to express their views on social media. They're certainly terrified to go to a demonstration.
We look beyond the headlines, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news.
Why is the volatile Wagner Group boss screaming insults at the leaders of Russia's armed forces?
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.